Scale can mean a few different things. I think about it in a couple different ways. First, scale, like just size, right? Like we need millions more people participating in higher education. Higher education has to change. It has to evolve. I get it. Yes. Read the room, folks. The public has very strong feedback that should be listened to and synthesized, because any great entrepreneur knows that you should be obsessed with your customer to learn from them and figure out what they need, right? Like higher ed needs to shift and change. And so I just want to lead with that, because I know the audience that watches your shows and listens to you is all about disruption. And I'm of the mind that it should change, it can change, and we work on that all the time.
Welcome to Innovating Together, a podcast produced by the University Innovation Alliance. This is a podcast for busy people in higher education who are looking for the best ideas, inspiration, and leaders that will help you improve student success. I'm your host, Bridget Burns. Each week, I partner with a journalist to have a conversation with a sitting college president, chancellor, system leader, or someone in the broader ecosystem who's really an inspiring leader. And the goal is to have a conversation to distill their perspective and their insights gathered from their leadership journey. Our hope is that this is inspiring and gives you something to look forward to each week.
Hey, everybody. I'm so delighted to have my friend Bridget Burns with us today. Dr. Bridget Burns is the founder and CEO of the University Innovation Alliance, which works with 17 public universities and over 500,000 students represented, you know, with these universities. Primary focus is how to accelerate or increase the graduation rate for students that are in poverty and students of color. But a lot of really interesting things going on. And Bridget's background and experience in education spans many years and done a lot of cool stuff. So I really feel like we're going to have a fun conversation today. So welcome to Ed on the Edge, Bridget.
I'm excited to be here. Yeah. And anytime we get together, it's going to be shenanigans, I believe.
It's always shenanigans, for sure.
Appropriate shenanigans, yes.
Important to make that stipulation. That's good. So talk a little bit more about the University Innovation Alliance. How did it originate, and what is the mission of it?
Well, I mean, thanks for the opportunity to talk about my favorite thing. The UIA has, so a lot of folks, if you're not familiar, people describe us as the Ivy League for Student Success Innovation. And that's probably somewhat accurate. It started when a group of 11 college presidents and chancellors got in a room together and decided to unite around a shared sense of urgency that we were doing a pretty bad job when it comes to graduating students. And if we think about the economic competitiveness of the country, absolutely need to do a better job. And there was also this, just generally, we're doing a terrible job when it comes to low-income students. And everybody is working in silos, tinkering alone, and there is not enough collaboration, highly competitive environment. And if you think about the thousands of institutions that are all repeating the same experiments, who are working alone in silos, we are missing a huge opportunity to team up and accelerate innovation and change at scale. So this group was basically like, hey, let's actually work together because it's a waste of time, energy, and money to go it alone. And so for the past now 10 years, we have been innovating together, scaling up what works across. Now we've grown to, you said 17, I have secretly 18. We're about to unveil the 18th institution. We set a really big goal, a North Star at the time when we rolled out. President Obama announced it, which was at the time we had 11 institutions and we were going to graduate 68,000 more graduates than their stretch capacity would allow at the time. So it was supposed to make them pretty uncomfortable. And at least half were going to be low income. And it's now been 10 years. And just with those original 11, we're now at 143,000.
Wow.
And that doesn't end until next December. And importantly, 89% more graduates of color, 41% more overall low income graduates, and dramatically outpacing the rest of the sector. So there's something magical in the water of collaboration. We actually think it works to work together, not always, but in this particular space and the way that we do. And so now we're just trying to see what needs to happen for the next chapter as we round the bases on year 10.
Yeah, and I don't want to go just blur through that, because that is absolutely remarkable of what you've been able to achieve. And that's just so important for our future. And so thank you and congratulations. You talk about the power of collaboration. What are some of the other things that have happened, with this initial group of 11, now 17, and we made news on our podcast, the 18th, that is coming online. What are some of the key things that are happening to show that type of impact and success?
Well, so the way that we work is innovation, scale, and diffusion are the three buckets, basically. So we look for shared challenges, things that everybody's got going on, problems that are probably not yet getting attention, but are going to get in the way of innovation across our campuses. But we also look for innovations that can scale, innovations that actually have evidence behind them that really work. And we try and actually take them from one institution to all these other environments. And so when we do them, and to answer your question, we've now had our 10th scale initiative across 17 institutions. We've produced an array of playbooks from that. We have done a 10,000 student randomized control trial. We've implemented predictive analytics, chatbots, proactive advising, any cutting edge innovation that you can hear about today. How the alliance goes, so goes the country. We started, that was probably 5 years ago that we did a project about whatever you're hearing about now. This work is designed that we are advancing work that is about 5 to 7 years ahead of the sector. And hopefully we are going to produce materials and supports and templates and insights that any university or any college can use to implement an innovation that we'll never talk to, right? Like we're not trying to create a consulting firm and sell this. We're trying to give it away because we know that we need every institution to be using the most innovative practices, because we need to educate millions more people. And there, it's just not going to happen if it requires that people, we know how, especially regional campuses, small campuses, they don't have any money, they don't have enough people, they don't have time. We need to make it so innovation works for them. And so, across those 10 different initiatives, can talk about, transforming college to career, really innovative work that is kind of cutting edge. I also, other things that are noticeable is that when we first started, there was the word student success was not known. It was not talked about. When we started, it was all about graduation rates and access. And we started trying to introduce this narrative that it was about student success and trying to make it so that, what if every student graduates? Right. What if to borrow from one of our member campuses, Georgia State, what if we're the problem? What if it's not blame the student? What if the institution has to is the problem? There are a lot more collaboratives now as a result. A lot of people are doing similar work. This was about changing the value system of higher ed. And we're kind of like the anti-US news when it comes to our social movement. And so lots of groundbreaking initiatives, other campuses scale our ideas, playbooks, other communities of practice that have formed. We're also pretty noisy online, broadcast shows on Inside Higher Ed and with the Chronicle of Higher Ed to try and, we think that what we pay attention to matters. And so we're trying to shift what people pay attention to, which is the stuff that is actually worth their time around innovation. So those are just some of the things, in addition to the 143,000 graduates.
Today's episode is sponsored by the University Innovation Lab, which is a digital ecosystem designed to help higher ed professionals just like you and I accelerate innovation with a wide array of tools, trainings, resources, and community all in one location. If you also want to drive change and advance student success on your campus, but feel like there aren't enough hours in the day, and frankly, you don't always know where to start, the University Innovation Lab can help. It was created with tools and templates and professional development uniquely generated by the UIA. The lab helps student success administrators and innovators advance student-centered change and improvement more effectively with more clarity, collaboration, and impact. To join our waitlist, go to theuia.org and click the resources page.
Yeah, which is awesome. And I want to talk more about innovation, scale, and diffusion, but I want to go back in your story a little bit, but also make the point, one of the things that we've always shared as this idea of elite equals excellence, not exclusivity, and how do you reach more people with excellent education so that can help them transform their life and participate in the future. And I think what this is exactly what you're doing with the Alliance. Go back in time. How did you get to being the CEO of the University of Innovation Alliance? You grew up in rural Montana. How did that kind of shape your worldview in terms of what needs to happen? And how did you get from there to here?
So it's serendipitous that my story directly connects with, I'm kind of exhibit A of the types of students that we are concerned about. Because my life is like a near miss from me still being in rural Montana, not going to college, all kinds of life outcomes that we can see and we can almost predict. So I grew up in poverty in rural Montana. And, you know, the only conversations in my family about college were that my dad would make jokes that if I wanted to go, that I should just do what my brother did and win a state championship in wrestling. Which, because he was a two-time state champion in wrestling, and
don't mess with your family. I can see that.
And he got a full ride to Ohio State. But so that's one example of someone. I'm not first generation technically, right? Like my dad was paralyzed when I was 2 years old, and about 3 years later, he finally cashed in his GI Bill and went to Montana State and got a bachelor's in computer science. So like two examples of people going to college that for me as a young girl, neither are relevant. Both their experiences are not helpful for me. I don't have a GI Bill. I'm not going to get a full ride wrestling. So you can have people around you go to college and it's still not useful. I fumbled basically when it comes to high school. That advice from my dad, a lot of first generation low income students did a lot of bad advice. Mine was, you know, basically what I took from that was if I was good at something, that I would get to go to college. So I focused exclusively on being good at something. And that I ended up winning a state championship, not wrestling, debate. But I completely neglected my studies along the way. I barely eked out of high school with a 2.3 GPA. Mm-hmm. So it's important for me to talk about
this. Won the state championship and debate.
Yeah.
Wow.
But no one connects those dots. Right. At no point does anyone talk to me about college or think there might be something going on or, you know, maybe, you know, anything. So it's important for me to talk about that because I think people have a stereotype of what a low-income student looks like.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, and also, you know, I stumbled to a community college. I have a really difficult time. It takes me 7 years to finally graduate, but it totally changed my life. And my experience in higher ed was very telling about the things that have to change and what I spent all my days working on, which is essentially I experienced it's not that people are lazy or they don't care. It's not that people don't want to help students. It's actually that higher ed was never designed around students. It was designed around the faculty. Mm. And if you think that universities can redesign themselves around students by themselves, you are, well, good luck. It's very unlikely for it to happen because think about the turnover amongst the presidency right now. Think about how much distraction there is. Like they start a new thing, they try and, you know, advance some change. And now all of a sudden it's a totally new team. No capacity, just so much going on. So, you know, collaboration is really the best vehicle if you really want to do systemic change. And this is all like, I'm very fortunate that I have that window into the lives of and the experiences our students have where they just kind of fall through the cracks. And, you know, at no point did I ever talk to an academic advisor. I didn't go to office hours because that sounds like when people do office work,
right.
Coded language, all of that. And anyway, my story works out. Like so to get to how I get to the UIA, college was transformative. Knowing my background, a year and a half after I walked onto the campus at Oregon State, which is where I transferred to, I was elected student body president. A year and a half after that, the governor of Oregon appointed me to the State Board of Higher Ed. So I'm 22 years old, hiring and firing college presidents all of a sudden.
Right.
And that's a profound experience that, again, college hooked me up big time. And I end up going on and being the chief of staff of the university system eventually, being responsible for government relations and speaking for the chancellor and all this. And I found, you know, I was ready for a new step and I wanted to know, I'd heard all this stuff about innovation and I wanted to know if it was for real because I'd had, you know, seven institutions I was working with, lots of presidents, but it didn't feel like that innovation talk was a reality. And I wanted to understand, you know, what's the difference. And so I got an ACE fellowship, which is like baby president school, and you shadow a president for a year. And I asked 30 people around the country, if you had 1 year to go and do this kind of a thing, and this opportunity, who would you study? And everyone said, Michael Crow. And they said, but don't go there. He won't have time for you. He's too intimidating. You know, it's a long shot, all these things. And so I managed to get a meeting with him, and I was very direct. I was like, I'm here to find out if you're crazy or if this is for real. And he just laughed, and we hit it off, and I shadowed him for a year, learned a ton about exactly how innovative leaders think and how they are really different. And the alliance was his idea, and he had already gathered the group of presidents to talk about the idea, and I was free labor. And so I, you know, built it and had to become an entrepreneur, because when he first met me, he said, you're a bureaucrat and we have to break that out of you and turn you into an entrepreneur. And living on an air mattress in Arizona for a year will do that to you, and chasing him around. So that's how I end up here is, I've been here for a decade, and it's wild to think, but, it's all these incredible opportunities that came, it all because of higher ed.
So Michael Crow is, you know, obviously a remarkable innovator, entrepreneur, leader. If you were to distill, you know, a couple of the key things that you think make him special and what you learned from him, what would those be?
I mean, how much time do you have?
I do think a window to arguably the most effective or disruptive leader in higher education, you have a unique window to what's made him tick. So feel free, take your time.
Well, since it's just us,
right?
and there was no chance anyone else. So I came in somewhat armed, skeptic to some degree. And keep in mind, so now I've worked with, I think, 50 college presidents because of the number of
turnover.
But at the time, I think I'd worked with like 20 something. I care about the presidency. I don't aspire to be one. I want to help them be better. And there aren't enough people who help them be better and be more effective. You look around, and one of the biggest problems with presidents is every day, all day, they are the only interactions they have are with people who want something from them or who work for them. And so you have to look for leaders who have really good peripheral vision, and they police it, and they make sure that they have people around them that say no and are candid. And he has, at the time when I met him, it was very clear he kept three people around him who openly tell him no on a regular basis. So he's very intentional about staying grounded. But I think the things that distinguish him, so I keep in mind, I've worked with a lot of presidents, so I understand this is not just about the presidency. His volume is completely unlike any other. I would say it's about velocity. He starts at 7 in the morning with meetings and goes until sometimes 9, 10 at night, 15-minute increments. There's no break. There's no pause. So he moves at a much faster pace than other people. He's obsessed with ideas, and I think that's his fuel. He doesn't drink, at the time he didn't drink caffeine when I met him. And every once in a while I'll see him have some caffeine. I'm like, you're making me look like a liar. His fuel is idea. He's obsessed with ideas. It's what gives him energy. You know, he's a voracious reader, skimmer, consumer of sci-fi movies. He understands science fiction is like a great window into the future. So he's like really interested in big, complex ideas and thinking about, you know, big systems, big complex ideas. The other things that really stand out, you know, when I'm at ASU, there's clearly a story on every campus. When I'm trying to diagnose what's going wrong or right with a campus throughout innovation, there's a story always, like, you know, we can't do that here. We don't have money. We're too unionized, whatever it is. At ASU, the story is figure it out. We're just going to figure it out. We're just going to figure it out. He has a comfort level with risk and failure that I've never seen. He establishes a footfault ratio he's comfortable with when giving someone a new assignment. He does not expect perfection. He's like, you know, give you about a 60% shot that this is going to work. I don't see leaders think like that. They don't anticipate that. There's so many incredible like moments that I could draw on that there is a very distinct difference about how he sees the world. He is really consistently inspiring. I followed him for a whole year. I never saw him raise his voice or heard him raise his voice once. He's the funny guy in meetings. He's not like he's intimidating to other people, but he's like a jokester. Who he is like very kind of blue collar. I think in somehow he sees himself very, it's not like elitist or removed, but he's a deep intellectual. He's also an enigma at times. if you get an email from him, like we operate mainly, I get 1 3-quarter of a sentence email from him every few weeks. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? anyway, I don't know if any of that's helpful, but he,
it's fascinating because again, his effectiveness is undeniable. You just a couple, reinforcements of what you said. I mean, the guy is nonstop. You know, first time I met him was probably like 2007. And at the time he was doing 3 dinners a night, and I'm sure he's never stopped that routine. So, I mean, it goes from the morning through that. And this idea of just this incredible, insatiable curiosity for big ideas. Mm-hmm. But the thing which I think is really consistent is just thinking always about scale impact, not little ideas. It's about like, how can you transform a system? Can you transform a group's lives? And so kind of going to the, you know, the University Innovation Alliance, you know, with that kind of mission of how to help the people that, you know, everybody deserves that opportunity to participate in the future, the foundation of access to quality education. I mean, that's been the kind of fundamental driver from the beginning. So if you think about scale impact in education, because that's, you know, that's how you think, that's how Michael thinks. That's what, you know, that's how we change the dynamics of giving, you know, this opportunity for all. What are some of the key things, how you see education scale in America, in society?
Scale can mean a few different things. I think about it in a couple different ways. First, scale, like just size, right? Like we need millions more people participating in higher education. Higher education has to change. It has to evolve. I get it. Yes. Read the room, folks. The public has very strong feedback that should be listened to and synthesized, because any great entrepreneur knows that you should be obsessed with your customer to learn from them and figure out what they need, right? Like higher ed needs to shift and change. And so I just want to lead with that, because I know the audience that watches your shows and listens to you is all about disruption. And I'm of the mind that it should change, it can change, and we work on that all the time. It has to change, especially around technology innovation and integration of technology, if we're going to serve the millions more people who we need to. If you look at performance over time, you know, we can still basically look at where you grew up and the family you grew up in and predict your life's outcomes. That's super messed up. That's a sign that the American dream is an illusion, which is the greatest threat to our democracy, is that belief.
100%.
And so I think that higher education is the talent activator, and we have to activate the talent of millions more people, or else we are basically showing up to a fight with our arms behind our back when it comes to the competitiveness issue with other countries. So what does that mean? Millions more people who are probably not in cities, who are probably not interested in an 1980s MBA, right? Like, we're going to have to evolve some of the things we offer. We have to make sure that the classroom is really as effective as it can be. And I think there are a lot of tools and supports that equip us with far better learning outcomes. We're seeing that. We are pro technology and innovation in this house, and scale is going to require it. So size scale is one, millions more, and specifically people who right now are deciding not to go to college. Like, it's very dangerous to grow up in a society of uneducated men. And right now, young men and boys are not going to college, and that should be very concerning. And for good reason, right? Like, again, this is about the American dream. Is it an illusion or is it a reality?
Right.
And so we have to make it so it's a reality regardless of your background. But the scale I spend my days on is, there is way too much focus on novelty and this idea that, well, they did that, but, you know, did that really work? I'm the person standing in the back of the room when someone shares about a new innovative thing, and the other universities will come up and be like, yeah, that's not really that impressive, or, you know, that's not, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm interested in that. I want to know what that is, what that feedback is. How do we, you know, what is the critique? But I'm looking for us to collectively kick the tires on ideas and see what exactly is this? Does it actually work in other environments? So what essentially our work is we take an idea that we kick the tires, we know works, So say predictive analytics or chatbots, okay? They are not the silver bullet. They can be if done well and implemented well. The implementation is really hard though. And doing it well and actually using technology products effectively in a complex bureaucracy, hard to do. So I have this 17 different institutions, 17 different leadership structures, different ways of doing things. Some are more unionized, some are not. Some are going through budget cuts, some are losing their president. All of that gives me a different environment for us to learn how the ideas, we learn how this idea might work in this environment and this environment and this one simultaneously. And we're trying to figure out like, how do they adapt it? How do you have to shift the idea? How do you evolve it? How do you have to tweak it to make it work in all these different ecosystems? Because the thing that was missing from higher ed is a method for scale. You know, we have Six Sigma, Lean, all these things and others. We didn't have a method for scale in higher ed. So if you're wondering why it's not as innovative as it needs to be, and we're not hitting the scale number, is because it's a lot of adorable tinkering, a lot of repeated experiments and failures. We don't talk about failure. A lot of the stuff in the entrepreneurial space that's very common never made it over to higher ed. And so we kind of do that work. So when we talk about scale, millions more people, specifically low-income people, across generational status, race, rural, urban, gender, all of it, we've got to step up. And that means we have to prove that you can be big and good, which is one of the fundamental questions of the Alliance, because all of our campuses are larger. We have to shift and be open to different modalities of learning. We have to make sure we're really using all of learning innovation. And we have to make sure that what we're doing actually prepares people for the workforce.
So you made a really interesting observation going back to President Crow about how he's not afraid to do something that doesn't work, which is unique in higher education. Frankly, it's unique in business. I mean, people just, there's sort of a stigma behind something that you try something that doesn't work the way that you hoped it would. I mean, how can that be? I mean, and obviously Silicon Valley works because you've been able to remove that stigma. Is that something that you think can happen, broadly speaking? Because that to me seems to be a key way to unleash, a lot of this innovation that we need.
Yes, it can, but it takes such intentionality. And I don't have all the power that I would like to have in order to influence beyond my organization. But I'll tell you what we do that works. The thing that matters the most is, and that people, should be grateful for, is people's time and attention. What we pay attention to, what we give our time to. So for me, I'm obsessed with what are we putting out in front of people? What are we? We have a limited number of microphones. There's a limited amount of things that we're going to be giving our attention to. And what is the architecture of those things? Is it brag reels? Is it high-fiving myself on stage because I'm telling you how awesome I am, but like the rest of us actually know the idea doesn't know only in that one environment? Are you actually sharing the nuts and bolts about how I can implement it? So what we do is you're not allowed to have the microphone unless you're sharing a story from failure, number one. Like that's a cornerstone from year one that has made it so that I will always preload the deck a bit and I will make sure I have a couple of people who are willing to share a story from failure. And then it's kind of like, hold my beer. People are like, you think that's bad? because you social. So first off, you do have to have ground rules. So we have Chatham House rules. So you can share the learning. You can share the story, but don't you dare share the institution or who said it unless you have their permission. And only one time has someone violated that and they're not in the Alliance anymore. So no, I'm just kidding. That it's helpful for us to know that's where our rules come from, is someone, stepping on a fault line and we're like, okay, we're gonna have to guard against that. I would say we need to make it socially safe for people to talk about failure because it's the greatest teacher. It's the difference between, are you a learning organization or just obsessed with efficiency? And I think it's the North Star. How do you do it beyond the UIA? Question mark. I think the thing I love about GSV is you convene and you and Deborah are community creators and conveners that identify communities that needed to exist that never did. And there's no one else who's holding that torch of making sure that venture, entrepreneurs, solutions and companies and education come together. The fact that those things were siloed and coming up with solutions that don't work for each other or making decisions that affect each other, but not talking to each other, that's how you get to real problems. And the fact that you guys are convening in that way. And I think that you have created space for people to share about failure. I think your stage is powerful.
No, thank you. I mean, I think the reality, when you look at any success, whether you're talking in business or, organizations, whatever, there's a lot of failures that get to that success. I mean, I have a talk about all these incredible success stories, but when you go peel back the layers a little bit, you see all the different challenges and near-death experiences that have happened along the way, but that's how you get to breakthroughs, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's so much I'd love to talk to you about, but in terms of technology, not just for the sake of technology, but where you actually see it applied, where it is making a difference, what are some either specifically companies or just ideas that you're excited about?
I would say the one that I'm most today is Mainstay, because they are fueling the chatbots for a variety of institutions, including my own. But also, I just came back from a convening where there are a ton of nonprofit higher ed access space and people who are doing direct service with students. It's from my observation, anyone who's doing anything with AI, it's doing it through Mainstay, where they are trying to they've enabled a tool that is learning about what students need and adjusting to the ways those messages need to be communicated to make the institution smarter and to better support students. So I love Mainstay and what they do. I think that there are a lot of analytics solutions that are pretty awesome. I really like Mentor Collective. I don't know if you call it technology. There's a lot of things that are technology enabled that are helping institutions be better at learning from their students and actually identifying problems and moving forward towards solutions. Those analytics providers, if you know one, they're all different. Even then, the solution is not the solution, because for every example of an analytics provider, I can find a campus who can say that didn't work for them.
Right.
And so for me, what I care about is there needs to be a true diversity in the field of options because of that issue. Because I know how powerful a story is on a campus. And if we say that we've done that, just find a different vendor, because it doesn't matter if that product is better. I know how this goes and how much wasted energy will go into trying to turn the political will to try a vendor again, or try a technology again. And so there needs to be a diversity of solutions and providers. I have lots of thoughts about what EdTech needs to do differently to better engage with universities and to help them be more effective. I think that some of the new AI enabled tools are pretty incredible. I think people are more nervous and not doing enough micro experiments. I think in the education space, we're kind of sitting back a little, very nervous. But there are places that are taking the lead. I mean, obviously ASU is, when it comes to learning innovation, they're 10 years ahead of everyone.
Right. What I'd love to do, because I think we could have a whole conversation around your advice to universities, how they can use EdTech to accelerate learning and to improve outcomes. And so let's do that sooner rather than later. But just as we're wrapping up our conversation today, how can people that are listening, watching to this, be involved, help you accelerate this mission? Because I think it's such a vital mission for the future of society. I mean, what can they do to be part of your movement?
So first we have, we create a lot of things online that make it easy for people to know what things they should pay attention to and what really matters. So newsletters, our show, our podcast, Innovating Together podcast. And that's all at theuia.org. Of course, I'm running a nonprofit and I will take your money. More than that, I would say I am out raising money because we are going up on our 10 year and we're about to launch an entirely new goal that I hope is going to be even more ambitious than the first and directly aligned with the talent and opportunity needs for the country. And the thing that I would share is that my universities match all the money that I raise, because it's not about what you can pay universities to do. It's shifting how they spend their own resources over time. That's one way. But in general, we are going to be holding a summit in October, the UIA summit. And we're also available. We're frequently at events like ASU GSV. If you had GSV and you didn't invite me, that would that would be weird because I'm like, I'll hang out all the time. So yeah, but theui.org is a great space to start out.
Well, as you know, you have a forever perpetual invitation to the ASU GSV Summit. You're a star there and you're vital for the community. So thank you for all you do. I really appreciate our friendship and appreciate how much you care about this. So thank you so much for being with us, Bridget, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.